Welcome to the Sermon Podcast by Church of the Nazarene. Stay tuned for the latest updates and new episodes by subscribing. Find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Join us live every Sunday morning at 9 on our YouTube channel. For in-person worship, join our English services at our Harrisonburg and Elkton campus at 9 and 10:30. Or our Spanish service at our Harrisonburg location at 11:45. Explore Celebrate Recovery every Monday night at 6 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in.
So to start, let's go inside the mind of a former college basketball coach. Oh, he reminded me, I didn't say this the first service, a former award-winning college basketball coach. Sorry about that. Award-winning. Whenever you say that, you have to say award-winning. Okay, so you're pastoring a thriving church in a city in Pennsylvania that's so holy, the city's even named after the birthplace of Jesus. And all is going well, and you're minding your business. When a church from Harrisonburg, Virginia comes after you, that metropolis, that urban center of Harrisonburg, Virginia, comes calling you, because that church sees in you a diamond and hope in a difficult time. And they come hard after you. And you're not really sure why, except God is calling you, so you go there. And your family's not really sure why, they follow you there. So you get there, what's the first thing you say? What's the first thing you would say? I mean, this whole organizational development thing where, you know, this primacy thing has an effect on organizational culture. The first thing you say matters a lot. You've got this organizational inertia that you want to bump a little. What's the first thing you say as a new pastor? Well, as it turns out, this is what you say.
I've only been here 1 week, but I want to make it clear. Our strategy here is not me. Our strategy is not going to be my mediocre sermons. It's not going to be Jeanette's great worship. It's not going to be what happens in the third service. That's a piece of the strategy. But I don't care if it's Esperanza Viva, or if it's this group, or down at East Rock, or eventually Waynesboro. The strategy is very simple. It's you. You are the strategy. Go all the way back to Jesus' words, what he said in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, when he says, you need to be my witnesses. And there were 11 guys standing there, and then it grew to 120, and now it's at 2.7 billion people who would say, go all the way back there with that small beginning. What was Jesus' strategy? I need you 11 guys. I need you 120 people. I need you to be on mission for me. And I need you just to go tell the story. When my life runs into your life and overwhelms everything about your life, go tell the story. Ultimately, here, I'm here to ask one question. Here it is. Ready? Who is your one? Who is the one person in your life that you have intentionally decided, I'm going after them? They don't know Jesus. And I'm going to rearrange my life. I'm going to rearrange my schedule. I'm going to know where they shop. I'm going to know when their doctor's appointments are. I'm going to know what their favorite food is. I'm going to know what's going on in their kids' lives. And I'm going to rearrange my entire life so that I can just, they're not a project. It's not, I write a name on a card and I just pray for them once a week. That's nice. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not minimizing that. I'm asking you this morning, do you have one person, an intentional one, that until one, right out of Luke chapter 15, that you would say, I'm rearranging my life. And the truth is, Kevin, I grieve over the fact that they don't know Christ yet. I grieve it.
You leave a church that holds you precious, you uproot your family, you move here, you obey the call of God, and the first thing you say is, as a church, we will have the heart of Jesus. One will matter to us. And that's why I'm introducing part three of Pastor Kevin's first series, 4-1. It's based on the stories of Luke 15. You have the whole chapter of Luke 15 in the YouVersion event. We're not going to go there, but if you want to reference it, you do. So this is part three of the series, 4-1. So where do we start? Well, how about we start with a murder mystery?
Precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I want each of you to tell me your whereabouts at precisely the time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was polishing the brass in the master bedroom.
I'm buttering his lordship's scones below stairs, sir.
But I was planting my petunias in the potting shed. Constable, arrest! Lady Smythe, but how did you know, madam, as any horticulturist will tell you, one does not plant petunias until May is out, take her away. It's just a matter of observation. The real question is, how observant were you? Clearly, somebody in this room murdered Lord Smythe. Who? At precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I want each of you to tell me your whereabouts and precisely the time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was punishing the brass in the master bedroom.
I'm buttering his lordship's scones below stairs, sir.
But I was planting my petunias in the potting shed. Constable, arrest!
So, were you paying attention? 21 changes? Almost no one gets all 21 changes. Even people who've seen the video don't get all 21. And over 50% of people don't see any of them. Zero changes. Over 50%. Don't raise your hands. I see by your nonverbals you got zero. You are normal. This video and others like it are part of a project by two psychologists, Chris Chabris and Daniel Simons, who've done work on the brain to demonstrate how hard our brain works at not paying attention to stuff, at filtering stuff out. Because of all the stimuli you get during the day, if you had to pay top of mind attention to all the stimuli you get in a typical day, by noon, you'd be on the floor drooling. So your brain has systems in place to ignore the vast majority of what you get. Nobody's hearing the air conditioning motor till now. Nobody's paying attention to the four red exit signs in the corners till now, because your brain decides what's important, unless you decide. We filter out, and we have to survive. In 1975, the typical American was exposed to 700 advertising messages a day. It's now 7,000 a day. What would your life be like if you had to process, top of mind, consciously process all that stimuli? You wouldn't survive. Now, if I had said to you before I played the video, now watch closely, I want you to watch this video. Don't watch it for what you think you're watching. You're going to watch for the changes. You've done much better. If I had alerted your brain, and then you alerted your brain to focus, you would have scored, some of you might have gotten all 21. If I had said before I played the video, now pay attention, I'm thinking that's exactly what I'm doing this morning. Or more correctly, what the Lord might be doing for us. So, we start part three of the For One series. We're going to be in Mark chapter 5 in a story that appears in all three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke. I'm going to focus on Mark's version this morning. Of course, it's in the YouVersion event. It'll be on the screen. Mark 5, we're going to be in verse 21 to start. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders, named Jairus, came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. Okay, so you're thinking this is a sermon on Jairus' daughter. You know the story. It fits with the 4-1 series because this is Jesus leaving and going to one, Jairus' daughter. So it fits perfectly. That's where we're going this morning. And by now you know that that's not where we're going this morning because I just told you that might be where we're going. It is not. We're going to do something different. We're going to focus on what happens while Jesus is on the way somewhere else. And I would suggest that this story being connected to the story of the synagogue leader's daughter is not an accident. So, first of all, notice in context, Mark wants us to know about this large crowd. He says in verse 21, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then right immediately after, in verse 24, so Jesus went with him, a large crowd followed and pressed around him. So it's fair to ask, why is the size of this crowd so important to Mark in telling this story? And to Peter, because Mark reflects most of Peter's story. Verse 25, and a woman, she's our focus this morning, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet, instead of getting better, she grew worse. So this poor woman has suddenly and unexpectedly entered our story, and she's literally poor. She has spent all that she has. And maybe more importantly, something we don't always pick up on, her disease is getting worse. There were two medical students who decided to try to diagnose this woman, and they wrote in the Nigerian Biomedical Science Journal in 2017 this piece. The woman with the issue of blood, as reported in the Holy Bible, suffered in her condition for 12 years before she was healed by Jesus Christ. Wish you could read that sentence in an American scientific journal. This review aims at underpinning the condition to hematology, identifying the probable causes and its diagnosis. Based on the signs and symptoms associated with her condition, menorrhagia, a condition characterized with prolonged menstrual bleeding, is the probable clinical condition she suffered. A low level of von Willebrand factor, other clotting factors, and disorders in platelet functions can all be implicated in menorrhagia. This is them continuing to write. Under Mosaic laws, a woman with an issue of blood was considered unclean and was put apart for 7 days. During this time, anything she lay on or sat on was considered unclean, meaning that if anyone touched one of those things, he would have to wash his clothes and bathe in water to become clean again. The Mosaic law also specified that if a woman had an issue of blood that lasted longer than 7 days, that all the days of her issue were considered unclean and she must be treated as such. That means that this woman had probably been unclean for 12 years and that she had to live put apart from others for all that time. To add to everything else this woman is going through, what would it be like to not have someone smile at you for 12 years? What would it be like to spend 12 years being completely unacceptable in a world and culture where being acceptable was everything? What would that be like? She would have been divorced from her husband, ostracized by the community, thrown out of her house, excommunicated from the synagogue, lost her old friends. as we hear her story, I just don't want us to take her desperation lightly. And I don't want to take her rejection softly. And as I studied this, I wondered how many people today I will see who are in this same position. Rejection is rampant. In the fourth grade, my fourth grade teacher had an odd, I guess now it's an odd tradition on Valentine's Day. They would tape small paper lunch bags around the room. So you'd have however many students there were, 25 lunch bags taped around the room, and each student's name would be placed on the lunch bag. And what you're supposed to do is that day, on Valentine's Day, you brought a bunch of, you know, those cheap, really cheap, one-page things. Some of you remember, absolutely no effort in them at all. And for the kids you liked, you would put either the Valentine or a candy heart, unwrapped candy heart, pawed by nine-year-olds, you would put the candy in the bag. So when students left home that day, they'd be carrying a bag of Valentines and candy, except Jill. That's not her real name, but I've learned these sermons travel. So Jill, in my class, had nothing in her bag, nothing. The way the trip home worked was I went to school in the inner city, so all the kids in a particular neighborhood would line up. They called it a patrol line, and you would all walk home together, and the patrol leader would drop off kids. And the image of Jill going to her house is indelible for me. All the way home from Lakeview School, she had held it together, that sweetheart. But as soon as she saw her mom open the front door, she started sobbing uncontrollably, running and holding her flipping empty bag, and I mean flipping empty bag, in her hand, and her mother grasping her in her arms. I think about her some. I hope she had a wonderful life. Well, she's not over yet. She's my age, so she's just at the start. That dear mom. No one comforted the woman in our story. Well, there was one. Verse 27. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Couldn't the story have ended right there and been perfect? Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. The perfect ending, except it's not. We're about to learn a detail from this story that I think is really important and really applicable to this series, which is why I'm making such a big deal out of it. Verse 30. At once, Jesus realized the power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding around you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. I think it's interesting that in this text, Jesus doesn't even respond to them. He says, "Who touched me?" And they say, "There's 300 people around you. Everybody and anyone is touching you. Why does it matter?" He doesn't even respond. He keeps looking. He's on his way to somewhere else. Don't forget that. He's on his way to a dying little girl. He's on his way somewhere, and he stops. His attention right now is focused on one. Is everyone in the crowd important to him? Yeah, on varying levels. But no one is as important to him in this moment as that one. The disciples see the mob, he sees the one. Augustine said, "He can always distinguish between the jostle of a curious mob and the agonized touch of one needy soul. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. I don't know how long that took. The whole truth for her is 12 years, 50 doctor visits. The whole truth for her, I don't know how long it took. All I know is he was on his way somewhere where a girl was dying, and he stopped and listened to her story. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." Immediately after that, we continue with the story of Jairus' daughter. Remember, these two things are intertwined. Jairus' daughter has actually died during this exchange with the woman with the issue of blood. Verse 35. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead." That's interesting. Look back in verse 34. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you." Verse 35, "Your daughter is dead," they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? We're told specifically, as something is happening to our woman in the story, something else is happening to Jairus' daughter. They're connected. He's on his way to resurrect one. He's going to resurrect one. Oh, and by the way, he does. Exhale. Jairus' daughter's just fine. He goes there and resurrects her. He was never concerned about how long it took him to get there. He was concerned about one woman in a crowd. And he doesn't miss the opportunity. He pays attention. Do you see that distinction in Luke 15? The three stories in Luke 15. You have the shepherd who loses a sheep among 99 and goes to look for them. He goes into the outer country to look for the sheep. You have a woman with the coin. She's scouring the house. She's going to the coin. But then you have the prodigal son. You know how he was discovered? Luke tells us, while this sinful boy was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. You know what the father was spending his time doing? Scanning the horizon. Paying attention. Ready for the moment when that disheveled, smelly silhouette of a boy comes over the hill. Paying attention. The mob didn't distract Jesus from seeing the woman. The distance didn't distract the man from seeing his son. So when Kevin asked us, who is your one? Who is your one? For some of you, that was a quick answer. You could think of it right away. For others of you, you weren't sure. So if that was you, my advice for you today is pay attention. You don't know who the Lord is going to bring in your life on your way to somewhere else, who is at least a one, if not the one. No, I'm not saying you're going to feel a surge of power go out of you. That's a Jesus thing. It's the only time we ever hear anything like that in the Bible. But you can be sensitive to the power of the Holy Spirit prompting you if you're paying attention. When I was in the Marine Corps, I was stationed on an aircraft carrier. And I'm too young for Vietnam, but many of my senior people were Vietnam veterans, because I was a few years after Vietnam. And I remember this one incident. There are about 80 Marines on an aircraft carrier, don't tell anybody, and then thousands of sailors. And in this one time, I remember I was walking with this Vietnam vet gunnery sergeant, and we're walking down Main Street in the aircraft carrier, just the two of us, and walking past us, sailor after sailor after sailor. And I remembered what he said, not just for the words, but because of who it was coming from. This was a stereotypical multi-tour of duty, Marine Corps, Vietnam vet, literally scarred, literally hardened. But he said something I just have never forgotten. He put his hand on my arm and stopped me, and he said, "Charette, you see these sailors walking past you?" And of course I did. I said, "Sure." He said, "At any moment, each of them is in the middle of their story. For some, it's a happy story. For some, it's a hard story. For some, there's a lot of pain. And if you will pay attention, you can be a part of someone's story. You can be a positive part of someone's story, but only if you don't look past them." I never forgot what he said. Again, especially because of who it was coming from and what he had learned from his life. Jesus, our Lord, didn't start out seeking this poor, ill, lonely woman. He wasn't looking for her. He was on his way somewhere else. But at the right time, he was so attentive that she reached his heart and he stopped in his tracks.
Instant, I felt it right away.
I know, but it wasn't this.
God blessed me today. And I know, my daughter, I know it has been a fight for you for so long. You must be exhausted.
I know that when Kevin first introduced this topic, my first thought was supposed to be on someone else, my one. But I couldn't help thinking of my own story. The time when I wasn't clean. And I was someone's one. She didn't look past me. She didn't ignore me. She wasn't distracted from me. I was her one. And because I was one, now I'm one of many. Amen.
Thank you for tuning in today. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and stay updated on our latest episodes. If you have any questions about our church or ministry, feel free to reach out to us via email at info@cotnaz.org.